humiliating and a violation of human rights. Ibrahim and other protesters also complained of being subjected to torture, beatings, and electrical shocks. Hundreds of protesters outside the court broke into applause upon hearing the verdict. They later marched to Tahrir Square, carrying placards criticizing the military for its treatment of female protesters. A recent incident in which soldiers stripped a veiled woman down to her bra while viciously kicking and beating her drew international outrage. Soraya Sarhadi Nelson, NPR News, Cairo.
The Mall of America, the nation's largest shopping mall, is back in business today, and at least 9 people are under arrest after dozens of young people got into fights yesterday afternoon. Some stores went into lockdown. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Intel Corporation in recognition of NPR's ongoing commitment to science and technology coverage.
That's Aaron Paul as Jesse Pinkman on AMC's Breaking Bad. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from him as we continue our series featuring some of our most entertaining interviews of the year. And we'll hear from Margo Martindale, who won an Emmy this year for her performance on Justified. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Jason Croft is at the controls this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with journalist Robin Wright. She has been covering the Islamic world since the early 1970s, has done a lot of interviews, talks about what she's found, has certainly written many books, including a brand new one that's just out, titled Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. It's published by Simon & Schuster. In this new book, she takes a look at the fundamental transformation that's going on in the Islamic world, certainly in the Middle East, but this is not limited to the Middle East. She says, in fact, that the recent uprisings that we've seen in that region, the Middle East and North Africa, represent the greatest wave of empowerment worldwide in the early 21st century. And she says that a key figure here, is the fact that throughout the wider Muslim world, people are increasingly rejecting extremism. And we'll be talking this morning about this current wave of political change that's sweeping the Islamic world. That's the subject of her new book. And take questions and comments from people who are listening. And that they certainly are welcome. We hope people will be brief and we can stay on target with the topic. But certainly your thoughts are welcome. You can join the conversation. Our guest, Robin Wright, has reported from 140 countries around the world. And her writing has appeared in a number of places, the Washington Post, the LA Times, the New Yorker, the New York Times Magazine, and many others. She has won a number of awards for her work, has been widely interviewed, and we're really pleased that she could spend some time with us this morning. And Robin Wright, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
I'm thrilled to be with you. I'm from Michigan, so I'm delighted to be talking to the Midwest again.
Welcome back to the Midwest. Well, you know, there are a lot of things we could talk about here. It seems to me, though, that one real central fact here for people to appreciate, and it's something that underlies the political trends that we have been seeing. One simple fact we need to get across to people is it's demographics. And what you're really talking about here is a political and to a great extent a cultural wave of cultural change that is really being driven by young people.
Yes, it's really quite striking. The Middle East is basically going through its own baby boom, and you have today more than two-thirds of the 300 million Arabs who are under the age of 30. And they have, for the first time, more than half of them are literate, fairly well-educated, either in high school or beyond, and that includes women. And they have access to the tools of technology, which give them a range to be aware of the kind of global changes that have happened elsewhere over the last quarter century. And so they want to be very much a part of it. And so we've seen the uprisings emerge simultaneously in several different countries, all over the same issues, even though they are in no way connected among themselves.
Yeah, this is something, the timing here is interesting, at least it invites the question. And I know that you have been, you've been writing about this, you've been tracking some of these trends for some time, at least going back several years. And you, in your writing, had been looking, in a sense, looking ahead to this time, saying, here are some things to look at, here's what I think is going to happen. So in your writing, you would have said, well, the time of change will come at some point. So the big question, though, seems to be why now, and why is it that it has broken out so dramatically in so many places at about the same time?
I think the key was probably the flashpoint. What was the trigger that would ignite the anger that has been welling for a long time? And that came when a young street vendor in Tunisia had it with the kind of abuse and corruption of the autocratic Tunisian government. And he took a stand after being harassed by a local official. He was expected to pay yet another bribe. He resisted, had a confrontation. They confiscated his fruit and his scale. And in trying to get recourse, he went from government office to government office. And finally, after being repeatedly rebuffed, he went to the governor's office, covered himself in paint thinner, and set himself on fire. And that happened in context of this demographic surge, the technology and the access to communications, to relay messages, the literacy and the awareness of the outside world, and it exploded. It's just the beginning of a very long process. But I don't think it's a surprise that it all ignited one country after another. This region has been rife with anger for so long now. We've seen it over the last 5 or 6 years, people rejecting both the autocratic leaders that rule as well as the extremists who, for several decades now, have defined the most obvious political alternative and yet haven't provided the kind of answers. And so people are looking for something different, and they're doing it imaginatively and strikingly, most often with peaceful civil disobedience. You have it today in the contrast of this transition with people still protesting in Syria, contrasted with the bombings in Iraq, the kind of the past wave of violence that we see still making an attempt to steal the headlines, and yet only triggering resistance and anger among people.
Yeah. Well, certainly, as you point out, this wave of political activity began in Tunisia, then spread to the next-door neighbor, Egypt. And in here, those two cases, we did see governments fall. But certainly other places where there were similar protest movements, they were met with brutal force by governments, and Syria probably is the chief example. And then we have Libya, which looks to me kind of like a civil war. I'm not exactly sure how you think about what's going on in Libya. But, you know, there was initially, I think, a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of optimism. This idea was, well, now there's going to be this very dramatic wave of change that's going to roll through North Africa and the Middle East. And it really hasn't. I'm sure you would say, well, you know, these things don't happen that quickly. But you do have to wonder what happens if people really become disillusioned. And then what happens to their willingness to use peaceful means?
And that's what we've seen happen to a certain extent in Libya, where the government has been prepared to use any level of force, in Syria as well, to try to repress the uprisings. And, you know, we've been kind of spoiled. We saw in 30 days the ouster in Tunisia of a man who'd ruled for 23 years, and in only 18 days the ouster of Hosni Mubarak, who had ruled for 30 years. It's just not going to happen that easily elsewhere. There's kind of a contest now. Which is the model for change? Is it Tunisia and Egypt, or is it, for example, a place like Iran, where in 2009 you had an uprising in the aftermath of a fraudulent election that lasted 6 months, but the government finally put it down? and their governments in Syria and Yemen who are clearly trying to imitate those tactics to use enough brute force to and the mass arrests of, you know, thousands of people to intimidate people off the streets. And it's really a contest now, and that's the problem. That doesn't mean even if the government survive that people are going to acquiesce and accept these regimes long term. I think there is that we've reached a turning point in the region, and however long it takes, however messy it gets, that millions, tens of millions, have made it clear that they want a different kind of political system that is both more open and more accessible and promises a future.
Yeah, it seems remarkable what has happened in Egypt could one imagine somebody like Hosni Mubarak that was in power there for such a long time and seemed so entrenched that now you should be able to turn on the television and here he is in the courtroom in a cage. It seems rather bizarre.
It's extraordinary. And I think the important message out of this is that the people have demanded a sense of justice, accountability, and the trial of Hosni Mubarak is more important for the values than the verdict. And that's why this is such a turning point. You can bet that every leader in the Middle East is fully aware of that televised picture. It's quite interesting, in fact, that the Egyptian court today announced that it will not televise any further court proceedings because they were watched across Egypt and across the region for what happens. But you can bet that everyone will follow what happens, whether it's by radio or just by newspaper report. This is a seminal moment in the Middle East.
Yeah. At the same time, I know, at least back when it happened, and people were looking at Egypt and they're saying, well, what really happened here, the reason that the government fell was because the Egyptian military decided it was time for Mubarak to go. And the reason they decided it was time for Mubarak to go was that they were very heavily invested in the economy and they were seeing their possibilities become diminished by this kind of chaos and economic dislocation. And they said, well, okay, it's time for this guy to go. But what happened really was kind of a military coup by another name. At least the military ended up in charge. And I think at the time, at least, a lot of people were saying, well, really, what changed here?
Well, it's an interesting point. But in both Tunisia and Egypt, the military was pivotal in saying to the leadership, this is no longer acceptable. We are not prepared to shoot at our own people in order to keep you in power. And unlike places like Syria and Yemen and to a certain extent Libya, they were kind of military coups, but the military also had to respond to its own forces. It was not just the people demonstrating on the street, but there was an awareness among the generals that there was an enormous amount of sympathy among the rank and file soldiers for the people on the streets. Some were related, some were young, that this was a phenomenon they recognized in their own lives. And so, yes, there were economic interests that played a big part in what their long-term interests were. But it was also a recognition that the military was going to come under pressure. As to a certain extent, it has it is now, too. The interesting thing is that many of the protesters have now begun to challenge the military because they haven't lifted emergency law, because they haven't announced a formal date for elections, and more importantly, haven't announced the election law. It's supposed to be sometime in November, and it's August, and people need to know how to, you know, run platforms, how to register to run, that there are a lot of important logistical steps that need to be taken. And so there's tension now between the military and a lot of the protesters, and this is going to play out, I think, for a long time to come.
Mm-hmm. See, I know that you have said that really Syria is really a place to watch here, and that what happens here may tell you something about what's likely to happen elsewhere. And the level of brutality that I think the administration has used to try to put down protest, I don't think there's anything else, any place else that compares with that, possibly with the exception of Libya. What do you have some sort of feeling about how things might be likely to play out in Syria?
Well, you're right that Syria is really the place to watch. Geographically, this is a country that has enormous leverage because it borders Israel, it borders Turkey, it borders Jordan, it borders Iraq, it borders Lebanon. So it's really a pivotal player, on the, whether it's on the peace process or with one of our NATO allies, Iraq, where we have forces. It's also a place that has always been the spoiler when it comes to the peace process. And it's really pivotal in terms of what happens there, because many of the Gulf countries, where you haven't seen a lot of movement, which are nervous because if Syria is to undergo political change, then they also will feel far more vulnerable. I think at this stage, after some 5 months of opposition and the enormous brutality the regime has used to put down unrest that now spreads across the country, that it will be very hard for President Assad to survive politically. Yet it may take a much longer time. He may win round one, but it is going to be clear that so many people in so many parts of the country have taken a stand, and so much of the international community has weighed in. And quite interesting, last week, the King of Saudi Arabia, a man who is among the most discreet diplomats and politicians in the world, publicly warned the regime that it faced chaos unless it reformed, that it demanded the end of the killing machine, and recalled the Saudi ambassador, as have three other Gulf states. These are not places that take a kind of public stand like this, and it's clear that whether it's Turkey or Egypt or the Gulf states, that the Islamic world has begun to take a stand against President Assad, as have the West, and particularly the United States.
Our guest in this hour, Robin Wright, has reported from all around the Middle East for decades now. Her writing has appeared in a number of publications, Washington Post, New Yorker, New York Times Magazine, Time, The Atlantic. She's the author of 6 books on international affairs, including a brand new one. It's just out. The title of the book is Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And just I'll ask you about the subtitle, just because so much attention has been focused on the Middle East and North Africa, and that's just what we've been talking about here this morning. But the kind of trends that you've talked about here, particularly the importance of youth culture and young people coming forward and challenging the established older leadership of their countries, this is something that you do see. You're not just seeing this in North Africa and the Middle East.
No, I think we're seeing it across the Islamic world, and that's what's striking. We see it most visibly because of the turmoil in the aftermath of these uprisings. But this is, I think we've turned a corner. And I think one of the things that's so striking is the fact that whether it's Pakistan or Indonesia, that there is a resistance to the kind of extremism. And we see it play out not just in the politics, but also just as importantly in the culture of change, whether it's the emergence of hip-hop as the rhythm of the resistance, that many young people are turning to music, particularly rap, to express their discontent, express their goals, to criticize extremist movements. There's the emergence of cultural outlets like playwrights who use the word jihad in their plays, in the titles of their plays, but a very different kind of jihad. There's an Indian Muslim who wrote a play called Till Jihad Do Us Part, and it's actually a romantic comedy. And it uses jihad in the sense of trying to be a good partner in a marriage. This is a whole different kind of trying to reclaim the idea of jihad from the extremists and to bring it back to what it originally was, and that's the idea of practicing your faith and your values in your everyday life.
Mm-hmm. Here, this is something that I think is quite fascinating, and I think also perhaps for people in the West, it's difficult to understand, and that is how people in the countries that we're talking about, how they see their religious faith shaping their values. Because on the one hand, they are, just because they're rejecting this kind of fundamentalism and extremism does not mean that they're turning around and wholeheartedly embracing the values of the West. But then how exactly does Islam influence what people want and what kind of country they say that they want to live in?
That's a wonderful question, and I think that we're going to see the decade ahead being shaped by two, what we will think sometimes contradictory forces when they're not. One is this push for greater political freedom, democracy, the right to free speech and the right to assembly, right to have a claim to determining your own future. At the same time, we see people also perhaps even more Islamic. It's reflected in a place like Egypt, where 40 years ago, most women never wore Islamic dress. And today you see over 80% of women wearing what they call hijab, which is the scarf, and conservative dress over other parts of their body. And it doesn't mean that they are fanatics or that they want an Islamic state. Often it means quite the contrary. But they do often, during this political transition, look to their faith, just as other faiths have done in other parts of the world, in trying to define what they want next. And this has been true whether it was in South Africa during the anti-apartheid movement when Nelson Mandela was imprisoned and the Archbishop of Cape Town became the leading advocate, or you see the Dalai Lama in Tibet becoming the leading advocate of pressure on China, liberation theology in Latin America, that during political tornadoes, people go to the pillars of their, you know, pillars and cling to the and cling to those things that identify them, and that's true in a in a political upheaval like we see today. They cling to their values. What a lot of Americans don't know is that Islam is Muslims think of themselves as a continuation of the Jewish and Christian traditions. That the only woman mentioned in the Quran by name is the Virgin Mary, and she's a role model for many Muslim women, that the story of Jesus is recorded in the Quran, that they recognize Moses and Jesus and Abraham as part of a single religious tradition, and that it is not, you know, Allah is not a different God. It's simply the Arabic word for God. And so it's not quite as scary as some of the stereotypes that have dominated for the last decade since the 9/11 terrorist spectaculars have scared us into believing.
We have a couple of callers. Why don't we bring them in, starting first with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Good morning, Ms. Wright.
Yes.
When the series of revolutions started in North Africa and Arabia, one factor some people said was the fact that people were waiting for these aging dictators to die in office and then have a change in government, and the dictators wanted to transfer their power to their sons. Now, is that in fact accurate or just a part of what's going on there?
It's a good question, and one of the things that's really interesting is the way that in Egypt, President Mubarak was grooming his second son, Gamal, to be his successor. That in Yemen, President Saleh was grooming his son, who was in the military or in charge of one of the military branches, to be his successor. That in Syria, the president was the son of the previous president who'd ruled for 30 years. That you were beginning to see a new trend of political dynasties, much like monarchies that are in the Persian Gulf. And people at, on the ground were unhappy and willing to challenge that system. But it's interesting also when you talk about the aging dictators. Saudi Arabia is a model, and that gets back to David's original question about demographics. The average age in Saudi Arabia is in the mid-20s. The average age of the cabinet in Saudi Arabia is 65.
Wow, there's a jump.
The king is 87 or 88. His heir apparent is 83, and the heir after that is in his late 70s. So we're talking about not just a generation gap, but two or three or even four generations in between the top and the bottom. And even in a place like Saudi Arabia, you have problems with high unemployment. So you get these monarchies or political dynasties in countries where they're facing real economic challenges and where the kids don't have jobs or a sense of the future. And they feel as if it may be, you know, decades before they really are have a chance to be part of the system. And that affects everything from a job to the ability to move out of your family home and get married.
Thank you.
All right, and we'll go to another caller here. This is someone here in Champaign County where we are, line two. Hello.
Yeah, I had something on Syria about this transfer of funds from Iraq, $8 billion. It's being chalked up as abeyance to Iran, but another Syria expert was on the show a while back and confirmed to me that there's like 1.2 million Iraqi refugees that had to cross into Syria. They're still there, living in really lousy conditions. I have no apology for the police state that is Syria, but I think that destabilization and that may be a factor in the Iraq, this Iraq's quote support for Syria in this time, when it actually gets pointed out as being a successful democracy by some apparatchik of the U.S. But I don't know how you'll react to that. But I also am concerned about the way that the Egyptian revolution is being portrayed as sort of, you know, somewhat peaceful. He's in the docket. Mubarak is in the docket for at least some hundreds of deaths, and there are some that are still not accounted for. And he's also in the docket for corruption. One of the things that I found one site for it in the New York Times, maybe I didn't search quite right, is this 40% of Israel's natural gas was going through this pipeline. It's been blown up a few times, but it's also was something like 40% of the world cost for natural gas, general market value, and this was seen as a rallying point by the Tahrir Square. Not much commented on, as is the labor dimension of the uprising, the date of the rallying force. Was actually a textile workers' strike date some couple of years ago now. So I know I'm throwing a lot up there, but I just think the complexities are generally not visited, and the commonplaces we hear from punditry is just doesn't do its service to the situation. You know, someone who's opposing this deal, gas to Israel, might be called an extremist. Somebody who's blowing up the pipeline might be called an extremist. But it's a really corrupt deal. Gamal Mubarak is supposedly getting 5% off the rank, raking it off the top. And there's very little discussion of it here. So I was hoping you would say at least a little bit about it.
Well, I agree with your premise that all of these uprisings involve very complicated factors. There are so many things that you mentioned. First of all, in terms of Iraq's support for Syria, this is a quite interesting development because Iraq and Syria have long had real political tensions. They were both ruled under Saddam Hussein in Iraq and under the Assad regime in Syria by different branches, rival branches of the Ba'ath Socialist Party. And it's quite interesting that under pressure from Iran, the prime minister of Iraq has announced support for Syria. This is really critical, particularly in light of the fact that other Arab regimes are pressuring Syria to at least respond to the protesters' demands. And Iraq, which shares a long border, has not. But you're absolutely correct that there are a lot of Iraqi refugees in Syria, even more in Jordan. And none of them live very well. Few of them get much support from the host countries and find very few employment opportunities. They tend to be those who could afford to leave the country and have some kind of resources, at least initially. But many of them are nervous about going back, in part because of the kind of violence you saw throughout Iraq today. There's a feeling that that Iraq, as the U.S. begins to withdraw, will be increasingly vulnerable, in part to send a message that the United States didn't win in Iraq, that the Iraqi regime does not reflect particularly some of the minorities, notably the Sunnis. In terms of the gas deal, I can't give you specifics on that, but it is clear that the traditional relationship between Egypt and Israel is going to be an issue down the road. So far, the protesters have focused on the political system. There is the danger, though, that as you get into the political season, as parties develop, as they have to declare both domestic and foreign policies, that in the absence of any viable peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians, that some of the political parties may take tougher lines on Israel and the peace process than they have in the past. And once they're on paper, it's harder to pull back. So I'm concerned about, you know, I don't think Israel, I mean, Egypt anytime soon is going to walk away from the peace process. I think that's kind of accepted. But what kind of relationship does that mean between Israel and Egypt? And that may not be as it was in the past.
In this hour, our guest is Robin Wright. Her new book is Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. It's published by Simon & Schuster. She has written 6 books on international affairs, has been widely interviewed, and her work has appeared in a lot of places, Washington Post, L.A. Times, New York Times Magazine, The Atlantic. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit, maybe a little bit more about 2 other places, the places where the resistance to change has been the strongest. And I'm thinking about Iran and Saudi Arabia. In Iran, certainly people will remember the protest and the violent crackdown that happened after their presidential election. And something very different, the picture in Saudi Arabia is very different, where it seems that what the government there has tried to do is by essentially handing out money, tried to make it less likely that people are going to demand change. But here there are 2 very powerful, very big influential states that have so far managed to push back the kind of thing that we've seen other places.
Those are 2 very good examples. And in many ways, Iran defined the kinds of people power protests that we're seeing today in the Arab world. I have many Egyptian friends who said during the 2009 uprising in Iran, if they can do it there, then surely we can do it here. Iran is one of the toughest regimes in the region. It is the world's only modern theocracy. It's the only place where clerics have actually ruled a state since the early days of the founding of Islam in the 7th century. It's a whole different kind of system, and where the clerics can declare someone un-Islamic or behaving in ways that are not compatible with the faith and therefore be arrested. And this gives them enormous latitude. And the fact that millions of people, again, spontaneously turned out on the streets the day after a presidential election, contesting the vote and demanding, you know, where is my vote? Why wasn't it counted? Has really been an inspiration to, I think, a lot of people in the Arab world. And, of course, Iranians are not Arabs. They're predominantly Persians and other ethnic groups. So they always think of themselves as different, even though we think of them as part of the Muslim Middle East. Saudi Arabia is a very good example of where a very nervous monarch decided to try to co-opt his people and co-opt any political uprising by buying them out. And earlier this year, King Abdullah injected $136 billion into the economy to create jobs, offer debt relief, create new institutions for housing loans, creating sports clubs, literary clubs. And, you know, for a comparatively small population, I think it's less than 30 million, that's a lot of money. And, of course, it's also reflected in the price of oil, because now to balance their budget, the price of oil has to be $86 a barrel. So that's had a rippling impact on those of us outside Saudi Arabia as well. But the question is, can the government continue to try to buy out the population? Is that going to create enough jobs? Or has the baby boom generation gotten to a point that it grumbles, it's not happy with the system? They may not want an end to the monarchy, but they may want more of a constitutional monarchy. This is a country, after all, where women can't even drive. And there are a lot of these basic issues that are coming more and more to the fore.
Hmm. And just, again, touching on Iran, as you talk with people, particularly young people, and if there are people who say, you start to talk with them about what kind of country they want to have, and they talk about the importance of Islamic values, then if you raise Iran, though, will people say, well, just I want to say that's not what it is we want. We're not interested in having a whatever it is. We don't want it to be a theocracy.
Yeah, and one of the questions about Iran has been really since the early days of the revolution, a country with the formal name, the Islamic Republic of Iran. Is it more Islamic or is it more of a republic? Mm-hmm. It has both types of government. It has an elected presidency, an elected legislature, an independent judiciary. But each of those institutions is mirrored by a religious organization or individual. So you have, for the presidency, you have a supreme leader who's like an infallible political pope. For the parliament, you have something called the Guardians Council, which is 12 men who are all religious scholars who can veto legislation, can overturn candidates and tell them they can't run because their Islamic credentials are not good enough. And the civilian and criminal courts are mirrored by Islamic courts. So you have this parallel system. And at the core is this struggle to define what is Iran. And there are increasingly, again, because of the numbers, an interest in more of a republic, even if it means not abandoning the system completely. I think there's a spectrum of opposition, some who do want to go back to something that's far more open, and those who are willing to look just for major reforms in the current system.
Right, let's take another caller here on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, I have a question.
Yeah.
Ms. Wright is obviously, you know, very learned in following countries with greater inequality, political dynasty, and young people who are having a smaller future. Lately, over in Britain, who has very similar economic and political policies to us, we've seen people rebelling and the government, quite frankly, taking a very pusillanimous response to these hooligans. One could argue, I mean, although things, we're not going that way. In fact, I'd say we're going opposite. We're, you know, thanks to the Tea Party, we're not going anywhere in that direction. But do you think that we're possibly in a danger here, this country, not now, maybe not next year, but in the next 5 or so years, with having the same kind of rebellions in this country? And do you think we're in danger of having the same milquetoast response that the British government is installing? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, that's a bit far afield from what we're talking about. If you would like to make some kind of comment, you could go ahead.
Well, I think the thing that's striking about what happened in Britain is that it also reflects the same kind of people power statement or reaction among you know, again, many are young, many are unemployed, some are unhappy. Because they have no sense of the future. And it's been quite striking how the leaders of Syria and Iran and Libya have all come out and said Britain has the same problems we do. You know, there's a hypocrisy in condemning us when you're just as unjust as we are. Obviously, that's not a fair comparison, but it is unfortunate in terms of the timing of what's happened. In terms of what happens in the United States, look, I think there is a sense that of political discontent in a lot of places because whether it's our own economic situation, whether it's the plight of the young, whether it's the gross economic mismanagement in some of the European countries, Greece, Ireland, France is now in trouble, Spain, Portugal, that there are many countries that have real debt problems that are going to spill over to the entire European Union. And so I think that we're in tough times, and the Middle East is not the only place where we're going to see resistance. I'm not sure any place is ever going to be like the Middle East in the next few years, but clearly there's a sense of concern, fear, discontent in a lot of places.
Our guest is Robin Wright. She's a journalist who's written a lot about the Middle East. Her new book is Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I guess a strong theme here in the book is writing about people who really want change, and yet at the same time what they're doing is embracing, trying as best they can to embrace the idea of peaceful change and rejecting militancy and violence. It's really striking that in what we've seen so far, the high-profile militant groups, and I suppose al-Qaeda would be the big one, had really no role at all. It seems that many people are simply saying groups like that, they just have no place in what we're doing.
That's really the ultimate message of the book, because I have covered now every single war in the Middle East since 1973. I've covered the two Palestinian intifadas. I've covered, the civil war in Lebanon, the Iran-Iraq war, not just the Arab-Israeli wars. And what's so striking about all of these places is that the protests started and in most places continued to be largely peaceful civil disobedience. It was in Syria where 13 and 14-year-old kids wrote anti-government graffiti on public walls and were arrested, that triggered a reaction and public demonstrations. That we're seeing a new kind of martyrdom. The young fruit vendor in Tunisia who set himself on fire was not trying to kill anyone else. He was trying to shame his government. And he succeeded in shaming his government and mobilizing millions of people in a way that none of the extremist groups in 30 years have been able to do. When you think of whether it's al-Qaeda or any of the other, Islamic Jihad groups that have been part of the extremist fringe for a long time, they have not been able to achieve anything. And not only that, but they also don't provide answers to the daily questions of life, whether it's how do you educate your kids, get health care, get a guaranteed job, that none of these basic issues are being addressed. And so that's why you see more and more, whether it's the young or their parents, saying, we're much more interested in a laptop than a rifle. Mm. And that, I think, is the fundamental change. Now, in places like Libya, where there was about to be a massacre in Benghazi, people did take up arms. And you're right to say that it's a kind of civil war. It's kind of a little murky, but it's clear that Muammar Gaddafi is very unlikely to survive politically. The same is true with President Saleh in Yemen. There again, you've seen largely peaceful civil disobedience, but there have been, because of an earlier secession movement and a tribal uprising, that you've seen elements of violence introduced as well. Mm. But by and large, most people are still looking for peaceful transitions, not upheavals or revolutions.
And at the same time, I'm sure it's worth mentioning it, and you always do that, just to remind people that while, say, an organization like al-Qaeda is much diminished, that it organizations that are similar and sympathetic, they're still there. There's still the potential for them committing some sort of violent act, but that their power perhaps isn't what it once was.
That's a very important point. The era of al-Qaeda is far from over. And the most dangerous wing, interestingly enough, is the one based in Yemen, where we're also seeing an uprising. And, of course, there's a danger that the two intersect, that the kind of political instability we're seeing plays out to the advantage of some of the extremists who are trying to take over parts of the country because of the disorder. And clearly, the branch in Yemen has been the most active in plotting attacks against the United States, and one of the leaders of that al-Qaeda branch of the Arabian Peninsula is American-born, educated in the United States. So the era of terrorism is not over, but it's striking that during the uprising in Egypt, which happened in 18 days, there was a message from Ayman al-Zawahiri, who is now the number one of al-Qaeda, then was the number two under Osama bin Laden, that took something like 3 weeks to get from its place of origin to broadcast. And it was just an audio tape that an era of warp speed Twitter and Facebook and YouTube, when people can send images instantly of uprisings, that it took, you know, on a different continent, the head of Al-Qaeda, you know, several days even to get an audio message out. And it was totally out of sync with the message in the region. It talked about 19th and 20th century Ottoman history and how religion was against democracy or democracy was against religion. Al-Qaeda is, I think, increasingly out of sync with the sentiment of the vast majority of people in the region.
In the past, I think when leaders in this region have talked about politics and there has been talk about democratic change and so forth, I think that they have sometimes chosen to muddy the waters by raising the issue of the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. What seems to be the case, again, with the people that we're talking about who are involved in these kinds of movements for change against their own governments, that somehow the whole issue of Israel just isn't on their agenda.
Israel is not on their agenda yet, but the danger is that in September, when the United Nations General Assembly opens, that there will be a new focus on the Palestinian question. The Palestinian president has indicated he's going to try to go to the United Nations and ask for official recognition of a Palestinian state. Now, this is striking in the sense that after years of conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis, that the Palestinians are taking a peaceful step in trying to get recognition. But it's also going to be one that is very contentious, that the United States opposes, and that may put the Palestinian issue back on the Arab agenda in a way that it hasn't been so far.
Well, we're coming down to the point. We have just a couple of minutes left, and I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about what are the places to watch. And we've talked about Syria, and you have said that it's very the way Syria goes. This is going to be very important determining what happens in other countries. But are there other particular places that haven't gotten perhaps quite so much attention that you would say, well, here's another place that you might want to look at?
Well, if I were in the business of predicting, I would suspect that there will be two more heads of state that are out by the end of the year and possibly a third one. I think the flashpoints will probably continue to be the ones that we've witnessed. One that goes underreported is the tension in Bahrain, where the government did put down an uprising. This is an important country. It's a tiny little island off the coast of Saudi Arabia, but it's important because it's seen as a place where you see the Shiite-Sunni divide, where you see the tensions between the Gulf Arabs and the Persians in Iran, and that will be one where the political steps by the monarchy, which is the minority, Sunnis, will be very important. I think every one of the 22 Arab countries will be undergoing some form of political change over the next decade, even in places where the leaders managed to stay in power.
Well, there you've at least mentioned a time frame. You talked about 10 years. And again, I think here earlier in the year when this wave of political activity was breaking out, people were thinking, well, this is just going to sweep the region. It's going to go from one place to another. What you're arguing is that, well, what we're looking at here is the very beginning of a process that's going to take some time. So having said that, are you thinking, well, are we talking about 10 years, 20 years? Are we talking about more than that?
Well, I like to point out that in the Soviet Union, a generation after its demise, you still have a former communist and KGB spy chief in power. That in South Africa, a generation after Nelson Mandela walked to freedom, the majority of blacks are still worse off economically than they were under apartheid. That change is tough. It takes a very long time, and there's the danger that change can be hijacked, and which is a problem because of the economic situation in a lot of these countries that can't afford democracy. Egypt doesn't have oil. Libya is much better off because it does. But a lot of these countries are going to face real challenges in finding that political middle ground that will be comfortable with democracy, comfortable with the West, and will provide a sense of stability and jobs. This is a tough time ahead.
Well, and what, just finally, what the kind of people that you're talking about, the young people in these countries that are pressing for political change at home, what would they like to see the United States do, or would they like to see the United States do anything?
Well, that's a very important question, and it often will be that the message is we are proactively taking our fate into our own hands, and we don't want the United States intervening. I think the lesson of Iraq and Afghanistan is that people want a change that is legitimate and which they define, and they don't want it imposed on them or defined for them. And that we're entering a very different period in the next decade than we have of the past decade, whether it's the rejection of al-Qaeda or the role of the outside world in determining their future. It's a much more proactive, much more imaginative and creative, but it's also, as a result, likely to be much more turbulent, even though there's a culture of change that complements it in a way that people are looking for peaceful civil disobedience, not just taking to the streets.
Our guest, Robin Wright, she's the author of 6 books on international affairs, is widely interviewed, has reported from 140 countries around the world for many different publications, Washington Post, LA Times, New Yorker, New York Times Magazine. Her new book, if you'd like to read it, it's just recently out. It's titled Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Did you have to get permission from the surviving members of the Clash to use that title?
No, I wondered about that, actually. But I do give them credit for being very prescient. The song came out in 1982.
All right. Hey, thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Always wanted to visit Cuba? Well, now you can. Explore the cultural and historic treasures of Cuba with WILL. Enjoy a 9-day journey beginning May 13, 2012. We'll depart from central Illinois, flying into Miami and on to Trinidad and Havana. Space is limited to 30, and the deadline to register is February 1st. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or go online at will.illinois.edu.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, preserving our nation's music heritage at the University of Illinois. Now featuring new exhibits entitled A Century of Stories and Sounds from the Stage, Music, Dance, and Theater in America. More information is at sousaarchives.org.
This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3 Urbana, online at will.illinois.edu. It's coming up on noon Central Time. I'm Celeste Quinn. Let's take a look at commodity prices. In March, wheat in that contract in Kansas City, that contract is up 22.5 at 697.5. The May contract trading at 706.25, up 23. March wheat Chicago 645 up 23, and the May contract 662.75 up 23.25. March corn 634.25 up 14.75. May 642.5 up 14.5. July 648.25 up 14.25. September 602, that is up 9. January soybeans 1202 up 39. March 1211.5, make that 1211.25 up 38.75. May 1221.25 up 39. July 1230.5 up 38.5. January soybean meal, $309.60, up $12.60. January oil, $51.88, up $92. The livestock contracts are lower. December live cattle, $123.35, off $95. The February contract down $107.50 at $123.25. January feeder cattle, $146.75, down $87.50. March, $149.75, down $70. February lean hogs, $85.72.50. That is down $12.50.